Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I'm hearing a speaker. Is your phone?
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. My guest tonight is Adrian Galish. And he has come out with a new album, an anniversary album, actually, of a originally, we'll let him explain what he's doing. It's called Venusian Sunrise, and I'm going to show the album here. It's just, when was it released?
This was released July 10th.
July 10th. So it's relatively, it's pretty recent. Yeah. So anyway, very cool stuff. I'm going to play some clips in a minute. Welcome back.
Thanks
it's
for
always
having
good
me.
To have you here, and he always brings an interesting guitar. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let's just talk a little bit about how this came to be, and because you have new recordings of it, plus you have you remixed the original album, which was in 1998.
Remastered. Yeah.
Oh, you didn't remix. It was
nope.
Just remix. So it's you get the original concept, and then you have the new mixes, and then there's some bonus live tracks, and we'll take a look at one of those in a minute.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about. Let's go back first and sure. Talk about the 1998 version and what you were trying to do, and then let's go to the new one and see where you've come.
Yeah. So back in the 90s, when I was in my 20s, I just finished music school, went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, and upon graduating, you know, got a job teaching as well as was doing a lot of session work. A lot of my friends who were studying to be recording engineers ended up working at local studios in the Washington, D.C. area. And so I was doing that kind of work and also just kept playing my own original music with my band and fellow musicians from college. And I wanted to record a solo record of these instrumental songs that I had been composing, at least then, for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. And in my mind, it was going to be, you know, two reasons. One, just to see if I could do it with a home studio. And back then, a home studio meant an Alesis ADAT recorder, a Mackie mixer, and maybe a sequencer and your computer and some guitars. So it was very limited. But at the time, I was like, man, hot dog. I've got, you know, some gear. I'm going to record me an album. And 22-year-old me thought that was a fine idea. And kind of inspired by guys like Steve Vai when he did his Flexible album on a single mm-hmm. 8-track recorder. Or there's a few other artists that kind of just got away with doing a home studio back then and making it happen. So I was like, well, I'm going to give that a shot. I'm going to apply all the stuff that I learned in school. Not to mention, my plan was to, you know, take over the world. And I wanted to get some kind of like calling card out there. So that was going to be a CD of my music. And so that's kind of the gist. I had these tunes. I wanted to record them. The album turned out pretty good. I mean, it sounded, you know, good for being what it is. Mostly, you know, back then I was limited by just the fact that there was going to be only eight overdubs, eight tracks. So technically what that meant back then is I had electronic drums on tracks one and two. That would be your left and right stereo. Mm-hmm. And then keyboards would be another stereo mix of whatever the sequencer was. So that's four tracks already. Bass on track five. Rhythm guitar is usually doubled, so that's six and seven. And then I'd have a lead guitar track, and that was it. So eight tracks, and that's kind of what you heard was some variation on that kind of, you know, instrumentation. And to me, that was enough. And I was a kind of a go-getter back then, meaning, well, not that I'm not anymore, but but I thought that, you know what, I'm going to do this. I hired somebody to do the artwork. I hired a CD replication company back when people were still buying CDs, and literally went to every record store in the Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia area and consigned the CDs, convinced the managers to sell the CDs. I would make flyers, do gigs. And lo and behold, a few months later, I would have to go and refill the stock they were selling, and it was going well. And this was also like right at the high point of like independent record labels and people starting to do that and thinking that they could do that, and I could. It was also the beginning of the internet as we know it, and there was websites like Guitar9.com, Guitarapalooza, and places where you could sell physical CDs, CD Baby as well. And people could, you know, mail order for CDs. And within a couple of years, that original pressing of Venus and Sunrise sold out. And so after that, moved to L.A., started doing more records with my band out here. And I kept thinking, man, one of these days I just wanted to revisit the record. Because obviously as time went on, the production value to me wasn't as strong as what was happening with each, you know, new record that I was doing. So that's how I ended up revisiting it this year.
Well, the technology too, the difference in technology and, well, let's take a listen so you can get an idea of the difference. Both valid, both completely valid, but you can see that, and also too, we were talking a little bit before the show. Yes, you had different mixers, but also, too, I think your ear, 20 years, it's changed in
oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and also, too, again, with the new equipment, the newer mixes, they're in your face, they're really punchy, and, but it's the difference in the equipment, a lot of that.
Yeah.
I mean, your dynamic range on your new record digitally is way superior than an ADAT back in, you know.
Completely.
So I'm going to play a clip, and this is called What on Earth. So I'm going to play the 1998. It's the same basic part, so you'll see it's a good A-B, and it's about a minute and a half. So I'm going to play the 1998 clip, and then I'm going to play the new one, and then I want to go through a little bit of the differences,
sure.
Like what you used back then,
yeah.
How you got your sound, and then what you're doing now. So let's take a listen to the 1998, and this is What on Earth. Okay, now, if you can remember, what were you using?
I remember exactly what I was using. So, chances are, I think on that track, I was using an Ibanez Gem. It's the white one with the gold hardware, and I still have it. And guitar amp tone-wise, it's a combination of this. It's a Marshall JMP1 tube preamp, and with an Alesis quadriverb for that chorusing kind of effect and the delay. And I ran the speaker emulation outputs from the back of the Marshall just directly into my mixer. And so that's really why you hear such a sort of a sizzly sound, you know, out of that guitar tone. So it certainly sounds direct, by today's comparisons. And that's kind of the only way you could run direct back then, was some sort of buffer or Sans amp or something like that.
No, but I mean, it does sound like, you know, the tubes are crunching. You're getting a...
Yeah,
and it's punch... I mean, actually, I'm listening through this system here. When I was listening at home on off of my computer when I was editing the clips, it's punchier here. So I'm hearing really... it's really much more... I'm hearing more fidelity here. So
it's a great preamp, and I used that live, that setup, for a very long time. And a lot of people were doing the JMP1 preamps and still do. The guys in Iron Maiden, Def Leppard, all of those guys still use those.
All right, now here's the redone version. We'll play that and then tell us what you're doing here. Using there, that's really, I like that.
So it's a big difference, and what I'm using is, so just so people at home understand, the new versions are completely re-recorded. Every single instrument I redid from scratch. So the guitar tone, funny enough, is out of Logic recording software. It's the amp emulating plugins that they have built into the software. Nothing special or fancy. If I remember correctly, I'm typically using one of the British amps into one of the half stack type of simulations, and a lot of times I'll tweak, you know, some usually boost a lot of mid range. I never really have the gain all the way up. It's probably somewhere at maybe the 75% range or something like that. But it's all right out of the box. Before we went on air, we had this short discussion. If somebody asked me 10 years ago, if you're going to re-record this album, how do you picture yourself, you know, miking up your amps and stuff? And I would have been like, yeah, well, I'll probably mic up these two half stacks I've got. But anybody who records at home knows that one of the benefits of home recording and recording on your computer is the ability to recall settings, EQ, whatever it is, and now you can do that for guitar tones. And for me to literally wheel an amplifier into like the next room or the bathroom, run cables, set up a microphone, do the cuts, not interrupt, you know, what my wife and the, let alone have dogs barking and all this other stuff, interference, to ever think that, man, I want to touch up a part, now I've got to set that whole thing up again and just hope it sounds the same, it's not going to sound the same, and it's such a pain in the butt. So the plugins on these on the recording software, it's a godsend. It's a lifesaver. If we were dealing with somebody with a budget, you know, a Joe Bonamassa budget, where you're going to have these, you know, $10,000, you know, 1960 something, you know, amplifiers. Well, yeah, that's different. You know, I would certainly say there's a big difference in tone.
We were talking before the show about Carl Verheyen.
Yeah.
And he goes to a studio and mics his amps.
And if I had, you know, his 30 and 40-year-old Vox AC-30s and all of his cool old Marshalls, I'd be doing the same thing.
Yes.
But I don't have those fancy amplifiers, so the difference in sound quality between, you know, my handful of amplifiers and what I get out of the software isn't as big of a difference.
Now, how do you get... what I've noticed, the guitar is really punchy, and I've had when playing with some of the plugins, it's hard to get that to really be that aggressive.
It doesn't start off that way. So you know, when I start recording, I plug into the audio interface and I start ringing up tones and I start playing and find something that I kind of like and start tweaking that. And even then, I'll lay down the tracks, and everything's good to go. But a lot of it also happens down, you know, during mix down. So you're going to be compressing. That's going to make it certainly punchier. It usually brings out a bit more of the mids and any lows that are in there, so it makes it a bit more fuller sounding.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just kind of squashing some of the dynamics. And, of course, you could always add that really high-end sheen to anything, mm-hmm. you know, at that point. So a bit of it is me just trying to be picky enough in the beginning to get a tone that I really like, and then I've got to hand it to the engineer who, you know, does the mixing. They're going to end up giving you that punchy in your face sound.
The other thing too was you had mentioned that the new album has real drums. You were using a drum machine before?
I would literally use a sequencer with whatever drums my Roland keyboard had back then, and with my fingers just tap in, you know, kick and snare, and then overdub on the sequencer, hi-hat and crashes and stuff like that, and do the whole song like that. And to this day, that's still how I demo these songs. And everything on the new recording started off with me recreating these drum programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least, you know, that's what I do for every album. The difference is now, after I have these, what I now consider, you know, demos, I select a drummer or whatever, and they end up replacing those, you know, programmed drums. Back then, I only had 8 tracks. There wasn't going to be a replacement, right. You know.
And you did that. You did the drums at a room. You went to a
correct. A guy named Ryan Green in Studio City has a place called Validus Studios, and that was Glenn Sobel on drums.
Oh, okay. Really nice sound.
Yeah, the engineer is a drummer. And he's really good at it. He has a kit that's in there that's already dialed in, and then we just kind of tweak it to whatever the drummer's preferences are. So what we get out of that room is pretty close to what you're hearing now.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to play the title track of the new version, Venusian Sunrise, because this was the one with keyboards. Now, I don't have the other clip. But I just want to talk a little bit about the differences now.
Sure.
You said that you redid everything. So did you go back to any of your patches on your keyboards or anything, or did you just go new?
So the bad news was when I decided to do the project. So the good news is when you're ever going to re-record an album, half the work is done for you. The songs are already written. The parts are already there. The sounds are already kind of decided. So for me, it was just literally starting with song track number one, recreating it. Track number two, recreating. So this was the first one I tried to recreate. And I'm telling you, it's been a long time since I've powered on and played this Roland. It's the same keyboard that I had back then. And it's now my MIDI controller. So there were most sounds I can get out of, you know, my Macintosh and out of Logic now, at least stuff that's similar. But there was a couple patches where I was like, nothing's cutting it. Let me see if I can find it on the old keyboard. Well, I turn on the keyboard, I plug it in, and no sound was coming out. And it wasn't like me just being an idiot. I checked and checked, put on headphones, and maybe some gurgling sounds. This is a keyboard that's now 25 years old, so it's probably, yeah, it's past its prime. So I couldn't get any of the original sounds. So it's me just trying to get as close as I could with the newer patches in the mm-hmm. software.
Well, let me play this one. Because the new stuff, especially like your strings and stuff like that, are really nice.
Yeah,
and really articulated. So here's this is the title track, and this is Venusian Sunrise. That's huge.
Yeah.
I like that. But I now the I like what you're doing with the strings. They're phrased like real strings.
I spent a lot of time doing that. I grew up listening to classical music. My parents listened to a lot of classical music. I was during grade school and high school. I was in the high school band. And there's a lot of great software out there. And I find the trick is yeah. Luckily, I know what that's supposed to sound like. And a lot of times I'll combine string patches from different companies. And that certainly adds depth. You know, some of them are samples where the mics are right up in front of the violins and the instruments, and sometimes it's from further back in the room. So if you combine those, you kind of get the best of both worlds. You'll have that very present sound of being right there on stage with the orchestra and then the other kind. So that's how you get the articulations. And then I'll also usually layer, there's usually a patch where you just play chords and it's like the whole orchestra. And then I'll usually grab just a single solo cello and a solo violin, and I'll put those in there and sit them just barely on top of that other part. And it's as if you're sitting, you know, close to maybe the first chair violinist, chair cello player, and you get to add that, you know, vibrato that's in there. And so that's, to me, at least my approach at getting some of the most realistic sounding orchestral stuff.
Yeah, no, it's, and then that song particularly, the big chord, the orchestra chord is huge. It's pretty huge, and you have timpanis and it's pretty cool. But you had this big string thing, and then all of a sudden, when you went to that quieter section, you hear the solo cello with the guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what were you using on there? I know you were using plugins, but was the what kind of wah, or was that a plugin?
No, the wah is I don't think they make a plugin wah yet.
Yeah,
you still gotta work it with your foot. That's a Morley. I think it's the Bad Horsey. I think it because I've got two Morleys. One is a Bad Horsey that I got probably 20 years ago, but I also have a Morley, like an ancient Morley, those old chrome bricks.
Yeah.
And I think I might have actually pulled that out for this. I don't remember. I think I tried it first with the old one called a Pickawa, and then end up replacing it with the Bad Horsey. The old one was just too nasally of a tone. And that's with my Brian Moore, I think, signature guitar on that track.
Okay. And the other one that we were playing when I played what was it?
What on Earth?
What on Earth.
Yeah.
Which guitar was that?
I'm trying to remember. Chances are it's... So the rhythm tracks were a Strat and my green Brian Moore that's on the cover of the original record. So it's the same guitar I recorded with 20 years ago.
Oh, that's cool. And, today you have the Sur.
Yeah.
And you use Sur now. How has that changed your approach to the type? Because obviously you're using a gem on the Ibanez. 20 years now, where's your head at guitar-wise?
You know, 20 years ago, my head was at, I want to be Steve Vai, so that's why I had a gem and why half the songs sound the way they do. And I remember as I sort of came into my own and ended up working with Brian Moore Guitars, at first I thought I was going to make my own kind of gem. And I even started, you know, the first guitar they sent me, there was even the same gem DiMarzio pickups in it. And that didn't work because it's a mahogany body with a maple top, and I just wasn't smart enough. I just thought I was going to kind of make my own, you know, version of this guitar. So they were like, you know what, let us put in the Seymour Duncans that we thought we were going to put in there in the first place, and we'll do that. And, of course, those sound great. And I've been using those guitars, you know, for quite some time, and I still do use them. The company isn't as busy doing much anymore, so... Hence, you see this guitar in my hands. And this Sur guitar is what they call the modern satin. And I was introduced to both companies by the same person when I was in college. And that would be Reb Beach, the guy that plays with White Snake now and mm-hmm. Winger. And he's had a Pensa Sur guitar from New York, one of those original ones that looks a lot like this guitar. It's a little bit different. And that's what he was using back then and still does use. But I remember one day we were in the studio recording some demos, actually, and he told me about this Brian Moore Guitar Company and that they had approached him about, you know, endorsing his guitars. And he said, man, you may want to check these out. They're pretty cool. Not for me, because I like the Sur guitar I've got. And so I checked them out, saw them at a NAMM show, ended up working with them and doing an endorsement with them. But this last year, I went to the NAMM show, and I was like, you know what? I need to possibly align with a company that's a bit more active, and but it's certainly not going to be, you know, one of the bigger companies. I always enjoy being sort of the small fish in a small pond kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So that's just, I think, the marriage that works for me. And so I saw these guitars, and of course, I knew that the guitars were great. Funny enough, at the NAMM show, they've got these locked up, like they're on the walls, but you can't take them off the walls. There's literally a lock that goes around the neck. So I started asking a couple of workers. I go, is it possible to try a guitar? And they're like, not really. We don't want these stolen. And I'm like, okay. But it turns out I asked or ran into a friend, and I've known this guy for about 18 years, and he's working at Sur now. And Dave Chavez, if you're listening, he's the guy. And so I asked him, I go, hey, what are you doing? He goes, well, I work here. I go, man, can you tell me who your artist rep guy is? He goes, well, that's me. And I'm like, well, thank God, because I want to check out these guitars. So he let me try out this actual model. This not even the model. This particular guitar was the one that I tried out. And the neck on these things is so incredibly smooth. And I know if I say, hey, it's got a satin finish neck, people are going to be like, oh, nice, you know, million guitars. No, this one is the smoothest, silkiest neck I've ever played in my entire life. And I couldn't get over it. And it was one of those instances where after I played it for even a few seconds and they hung it back up on the wall, I could not stop thinking about this guitar. And the more research I did, the more I found out, well, man, you know, the pickup selection, it's two humbuckers like my Brian Moore guitar. It goes from humbucker to a split single. And then it's a combination of the humbuckers. And then it's a single coil in the neck position. And then when you finally get to the end of the five-way switch, it's the humbucker. And then I go, well, man, my Brian Moore splits, you know, my bridge pickup. Does this do that? Well, it turns out you can if you push this knob. And I'm like, well, this gives me all the same sounds that I'm used to. And it's kind of the same setup. And it's, again, another mahogany body with a satin finish. But it didn't have gold hardware. And that's kind of my thing. I like gold hardware, especially if a guitar is expensive, I want it to look expensive. And so this guitar, what I tried it out at the NAMM show, had chrome hardware and sort of those Les Paul type of plastic speed knobs. And I'm like, I want that guitar, but can you guys just dress it up in gold? And they're like, yeah, no problem. And so that's what I'm sitting here with now.
Show us a little bit of your Brian Moore, because they're so unique.
Yeah.
I would think nowadays you'd be less prone to taking those out because the theft problem.
The Brian Moores are unique. They're great playing guitars, and the problem is the two Brian Moores that I have been such workhorses and used so much. They're starting to show their age. Like literally, I've got dings on the back of the neck. The frets probably need to be refretted, and you know, strings are falling off the sides. That things are so worn out. The signature model with the spalted maple top, it's a satin top, and spalted maple is a pretty soft wood. And I've got literally grooves and holes and stuff from, you know, my fingernails and the pick. And I got to thinking, I'm like, this guitar isn't going to have a longer life. I probably just need to kind of put it away and play it whenever I want to, yeah, you know, revisit that guitar. So I was hoping to find something that was similar, and I think I got it.
Well, I know this is a special guitar, and obviously it spoke to you. But in the case of something, if you needed another one, they can duplicate this, right?
Oh, yeah. They make these, you know, all day long. So.
And they're consistent. That's the thing. That's Well, go ahead and just go through the sounds and the tones a little bit, just so people get an idea.
You know what? I'm going to turn the distortion off, and that way you'll get a better idea.
Okay, and I just want to mention, I want to thank my friends from Simple Way. I'm using their condenser mic on this to show you. and Gary Rodenko at the Bass Exchange, the Amp Shop Bass Exchange. He's letting me borrow this. But this does capture the sound of this going through this amp.
And I do an amazing Gary impersonation. Oh. Yeah, this is Gary from Amp Shop. So this is the humbucker. Just as you would expect any, you know, humbucker to sound.
Right.
Next switch, I believe, does one thing. It does, so that's the first position, bridge position. And then if you move it over, you got single. So it's it splits both, I believe. And you get
so
that.
So it's like a tone.
Next one is cool. It's the middle selection, and it's both humbuckers. And then, of course, next would be just the single coil split from the neck pickup. Let's see.
Or Duncan's?
These are not. These are Sir pickups.
Sir pickups, because that sounds like a nice Strat bridge pickup.
So
pickup. That sounds really good for a split humbucker.
And that's what I told the guy at Sir after they sent the guitar. You know, he called me to see, hey man, what do you think? What do you think? And you know, I think there's two different kind of guitarists out there when it comes to gear. There's the one that sort of, when you get a new guitar, you kind of put it up on the stand, you circle it like a cat, you play it a little bit, you come back to it, you play it a little bit more. I'm that guy. There's other people that are like, man, I just couldn't get my hands off of it, and I've been playing it nonstop for the last 24 hours. Well, that wasn't me. So, you know, the guy was like, what do you think? What do you think? So I finally said, man, the thing that really got me was the single coil tones from a split humbucker. Because in my experience, whenever you've done that, even if they're great humbuckers, it sounds, when you split them, you're getting like maybe 75% great sounding single coils, like you would expect from a Strat. And when I heard these single coils, I was like, man, these sound just great as the tone, as a single coil tone, like on its own, let alone as the humbuckers. So I was really happy about that. It's a very much a more usable tone than I've experienced before. And then, of course, we've got the humbucker.
So the five positions does the pickup splits. So when do you use that push-pull?
So if you remember, though, the second position was single. So if I go back to the bridge and then I do the push-push or whatever it is on the tone, that splits the bridge pickup.
So that just that.
So that's it.
That's humbucker.
No humbucker.
Okay, for just that one pickup.
Yeah,
okay. So yeah, you got all the flavors. That's pretty.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And I'm that kind of player. You know, if you come see me at the Big Potato, it's like I'm gonna play one guitar the whole night, and it's got to be good at blues. It's got to be good at, you know, a clean tone. It's got to be good at that overdrive, you know, lead guitar sound. And I'm not the guy that's, you know, switching Les Pauls and Strats and 335s all night long.
Well, I'm going to play another clip from the album. This is called, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to play, because I have two. One of the things that's cool about this album, besides the two versions of the album, he threw in a couple of bonus tracks of the live clips of. So I'm going to play, this one's Lydian Dreams. So I'm going to play the studio version, and I'll play the live version. But I want to ask, what the part I'm playing is, there's an answer between two guitar parts. So one of the things I want to show is the difference in the tones and how you achieve that. And then also, too, one of the things is you use a lot of gain in the plugin. I mean, but your articulation's right on the money. I just want to kind of go a little more into that, your technique, how you get that articulation with all that gain. So here's the studio version of the Lydian Dreams. Take a listen.
Yeah.
very cool. But you're playing against yourself.
Yeah. So the original track and the original way I play it, there's a line that's tapped out. And then it's back to... And then there's an answer to that. But then you're hearing that middle sort of guitar. If you have the album, you'll hear double tracks of what I just played, left and right. And then up the middle is this, I don't even know what the heck I played. But it's this other track. So that's where you're hearing a call and response. And the response part really, to me, it wasn't there on the original recording. So, you know, people ask, well, what's the difference between the new album and the old one besides the new one sounds better? I'm like, well, more mature Adrian, who knows a little bit better, is going to try to make things more interesting. So towards the end, I knew I kind of wanted sort of this chorus outro sort of effect. And so if I remember correctly, the main guitars that I just sort of showed you, probably my Brian Moore, the green one. And the middle guitar, I believe, may be the same thing. I think I might have tried it with a Strat, because that's sort of that sound I wanted out of the neck pickup. But to me, with the Strat I have, as much as I like it, just doesn't play as well, so I couldn't get the licks out that I wanted to get. And so I think I just used that green one again.
What amp plugins did you use?
Did you
change it, or did you use
different? Yeah, it's different. And sometimes it's not so different, other than the fact that maybe what I sometimes do to get the tones to stand out is, you know, because the difficult part with that song is the double track parts are the melody for most of the track, for most of the song, and they are how the song goes. And so you can't, you know, scoop out mids and then put a hot mid, you know, lead track over that, because they need to stand on their own for the rest of the song. So a lot of times I'll move the mic around, so if it's right up in the middle of the cone, then you're going to get a bright sound. If it's a little off center, then it's going to be a little bit mellower of a tone, and so that usually helps. Or I'll EQ it different, or since I know if I'm double tracking a part like I just showed in the rhythms, then I don't need that much gain. I'll have it literally at 50%. And I mean, if you listen to like old AC/DC records, there's not that much distortion, and it's a very heavy, big sound. So that's always been my approach. And although it sounds like a lot of gain, even on the solo guitar parts, none of it was really past 2 or 3 o'clock.
Really?
Yeah. I find that a lot of those plugins, maybe it's an exaggeration or something of how much gain they've got in the plugins, but I find that, man, past, you know, the 3 o'clock position, it's like way too much.
Well, it sounds to me that it's just that your guitar sustains a lot, so it has that, it holds the tone better.
Yeah.
It doesn't die. It doesn't die fast. Like, maybe that's what's, like, the Strat sometimes will die fast.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking this earlier about, like, Hendrix. When you have amps really loud, you have this clean sound, but then it'll feedback, or you'll get this amazing tone
or sustain
yeah, but yeah, it's because of the volume interacting with the pickups. So now, use just what you were talking about, breaking up that song. Now let's talk a little bit, because I'm going to play the live clip. How do you approach it live? Do you try to make the parts, bring out those different parts?
So here we've got, so this is the strange thing. So in the original recording that came out 20 years ago, you know, it was one arrangement. And we've tended to keep to the songs most of the time, but I've had 20 years to develop it live. And that might mean that live, it might, I don't know if it's quicker, it might even be slower, who knows. So a lot of times the timing, sense of tempo changes. I know that the call and response solo towards the end isn't there live, because it's something that didn't occur to me until I had to re-record the album. So the approach is probably me just trying my best to not screw up.
And then on this live clip, what are you using? Because you're using an amp, too.
Yeah, so. That's... so, wow. So that was in 2011, before the amp upgrade. And that's my green Brian Moore into the Marshall JMP1. And believe it or not, a broken Alesis Quadreverb into, I think, a PV tube 50-50 power amp running into a Marshall Vintage 1960 4x12. That was my tone for a very long time. But, man, the little rack-mounted stuff I was dragging around was so heavy and so cumbersome and noisy that I recently ended up getting a couple other amp heads to replace it.
Okay, and then the guitar that was the Brian Moore?
The Brian Moore, the green one, yeah.
The green one. All right, let's listen to the live clip. Take a listen. It's interesting, your ear, because even with the plugins, your tone is pretty consistent between even over
it
the...
It should kind of be, you know, and I know... So the venue, this was literally recorded from a nice video camera. That's all it is a room mix. And so my hat's off to the guy who engineered the sound that night. This was at Club Nokia. I don't know what it's called now, but downtown... next to Staples Center is where this was taken from.
All right, let's take a listen. I had to put that bass. That bass is great.
That was an on night. That was Philip Bino. People know him. He's usually on tour with Steve Vai, and that was Charlie Waymire on drums. That was
they're great. I mean, yeah. I can see how you took advantage of the rhythm section because there's some rhythmical things.
Yeah,
just
you're right
before the bass solo.
So in the original recording, in that section, the breakdown after the solo. There's a really, by today's standards, a stupid sounding, you know, percussion section, and of course I'm like, well, we're not going to play percussion, guys. So live, it's evolved into this solo trade between the drums and the bass.
Because I really like I love I'm going to play it. There's a couple other clips, and the one I'm going to take us out to is again another. You have some great interactions with the bass players. So let me go ahead and play this other clip because we're almost out of time.
Okay.
Let's see. This is called Drifting Memories. And take a listen how the interaction between the guitar and the bass. This is a really interesting. I love this, what you're doing. It's really cool what's happening here. that's cool.
So that's Stu Hamm, and you can't go wrong with having him play bass on a track. And I remember, you know, I sent him the rhythm section and maybe... Actually, I think I just sent him a mix without any bass on it. And I sent him the demo with the bass on it that I had played. And, of course, he's like, you want me to play what you played or you want Stu? And I'm like, well, send me both. He goes, all right. And, of course, he sends me two tracks, and one of them, you know, is his version of my uninspired bass playing, and then the other one is, like, him being, you know, the experienced, awesome bass player that he is. And for that section, I had forgotten what the hell I had done, but I knew guitar-wise.
So you went back after he sent you the part, you went back and then played to it?
No.
Or you already had done your part?
I had already done all my parts. But, you know, half of the challenge with this record was kind of just figuring out what the hell I played 20 years ago. Guitar was easy. Everything else was like, well, I don't know. I haven't played this on bass or keyboards, you know, since I was 22 years old. But the middle section was, you know, that kind of tapping thing. And I think the bass part originally was something like sort of a samba feel. And I'm like, if I'm going to have Stu on here, I've got to make some use of that. And my guitar part originally had a harmony part to that tapping section. I'm like, and as I recorded the part with the harmony, I'm like, this is getting muddy. It's not really translating. It doesn't sound cool. Maybe Stu can come up with something on bass. And yeah, he came up with this really weird double-handed tapping thing that you just heard. It's very cool.
It's amazing. And how did you get him to come on the? How did that happen?
I've ran into him on and off over the years, but you know, never really had a chance to, you know, obviously play together until I think this past April or May. We did one of those things, those jams at Soundcheck Live down in Hollywood, and we ended up playing on a couple songs together. And we had a good time, and on his way out that night, he's like, hey, man, let me know if you ever, you know, want to play again. And I'm like, well, shit, yeah, let's do that. So I got to thinking about it. I go, man, there's two tracks on here that are suffering from, you know, lame bass playing a la me that have a couple spots for a bass part to shine. And that's the one you just heard, Drifting Memories, and then The Blue Jungle has, right before my outro solo, an actual bass solo. And so I asked him. He said, yeah, send me the tracks.
Well, I have that clip. We're out of time, and I just want to thank you for coming on.
No problem.
And check this album out, Venusian Sunrise 20th Anniversary Version. You get basically like 2.5 albums because you have the old album, the new album, and you get these bonus tracks with the live. And you heard a little bit from the live. It sounds great. You're right. That's pretty good for a video.
I wanted to make sure that the CD had as much music that you could possibly fit on a CD. It's literally just over 70 minutes of music. You really can't fit a minute more on there. And I wanted fans and people to get their money's worth.
That's cool. And also check out, is it www.adriangalish.com?
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of stuff up there about what he's doing. And where are you going to be playing?
I'm usually doing my acoustic thing with Agazadra. We'll be in Moore Park on the 21st of September and at D'Argenzio Winery in Burbank on the 22nd, which is a Saturday. And that's Randy Rhodes' sister's winery. And they've got live music there. We'll be playing there.
Cool.
Yeah.
And now that's anything with that's going to feature this album?
You know what? I'm still looking to book things with that. You can usually find me at the Baked Potato, hopefully sometime in the next couple months.
Okay. All right. So everybody have a great week. Again, it's Venusian Sunrise 20th Anniversary Edition. This is what it looks like. And this is that clip that he's talking, and I pulled the bass solo. It should be on here. And I'm playing the whole end of the of the piece. This is... Blue Jungle.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for
coming
on.
Thanks for having me.
I look forward to the next one. So, everybody have a great night. We will see you next week.